Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Tim Sullivan, and Tim is a graduate of Carolina. He was a Morehead Scholar, and he's the former CEO of Ancestry.com. So we want to talk to him, or get him to talk to us about how that came from Carolina to the head of one of the fastest growing and most important .com businesses. Tim, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, you came to talk, to give the principal talk, the Eve Carson lecture series. Yeah. And it's had a great history, and I think you topped it off with a wonderful talk the other night. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. It was a pleasure and honor.
How were they able to persuade you to come?
If someone asks me to come and speak on campus at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, I'm gonna be there. I love this place. Frankly, any excuse to come back to Chapel Hill and re-immerse myself in the life of this great university is a treasure. I was really honored to do it.
Tell us a little bit about your time at Chapel Hill as a student. How'd you happen to come here?
Where'd you come from? I grew up in upstate New York, I had never even been to North Carolina when I was nominated for this thing called a Morehead Scholarship. And so I came down here.
Were you a prep school?
I was at a boarding school called Hotchkiss in Lakeville, Connecticut, which was about an hour and a half from my home in Albany, New York.
Oh, my gosh.
And came down to this state and this town and this campus and was completely in love, really, from the moment I stepped foot here. It was a phenomenal financial benefit to also receive this scholarship and not have to pay for college. But it really was.
You were in a boarding school. Your family wasn't destitute.
Well, no. We were comfortable, but my two older brothers and my younger sister all went to the school, but we were all on financial aid. My dad was a very successful doctor, but it was meaningful to be able to get a scholarship to go to college. But the Morehead was so attractive to me, and I knew about it. A friend of my older brothers had received this, so I had learned quite a bit about it. I was all in from the very beginning. There was no choice for me. Once I received it, I was all in and excited to accept it.
We've had quite considerable success in business. And did the Morehead experience, other than just being at Carolina, have anything to do with that?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. One, the great opportunity to have really rich, engaging summer internships as a young guy in college was really wonderful experience. To learn specifically about any of the industries or the businesses that I worked for, but just to learn about how to work in a company and get started early in figuring out how to to have a job, even though it was a summer internship. Plus, I will say that being a Morehead Scholar on campus, you didn't have a sign on your forehead that you were a Morehead Scholar.
Some people knew, but
a lot of people didn't. You were just part of the student body. I had a confidence that I could kind of go figure things out, knowing that I had the Morehead Foundation had my back.
Well, you told the story in your talk or in your conversation with John Wilson about starting a business that you and he started what seems not to be too advanced, but a TV business in the early 1980s.
Right after we graduated. Well, John, I worked with John during our college years. And a group of other folks, including his wife Ashley and some other folks, to start the student television program, STV, at Carolina. And then that really led us, and again, I'll give John the credit for leading this charge, that we started a video production company here in the Triangle.
Branching out of the student television experience.
Taking that experience. Yeah. We both loved it and loved the idea of production and creating these stories and putting them on film. I mean, these were early days of video
production.
How
did you get them on – you got them on a cable? Or you got them – or you just put them on
– Yeah, we had cable access. We had a cable access channel on Village Cable.
On Village Cable,
Cable. Okay. We would have students, I think, every night – or not – when we aired one of these programs, we would all meet at Mr. Gaddy's, a pizza place on Franklin Street, because there was no cable in the dorms. But it was – look, there was incredible talent and energy at the university among the students to produce content. There was a Department of Radio, Television, and Motion Picture. But no – there was no outlet for this.
So, you provided the department a way for their students, if they wanted to come produce – help you all produce programs.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But you weren't a part of that.
No, I was not. John was a biology major and I was a political science major.
Well – and then – so that led to a little business
– UAV Productions.
And what was that all about?
So I think we both fell in love with this idea of creating content on video. And we started a video production company. And for most of our work
– this is after you got out of school.
After we got out of school. I think our first big project was for the university and producing some recruiting films and I think maybe a development video. Mm-hmm. And then we branched out and did work for a number of colleges and secondary schools throughout the Southeast. I mean, it was a very varied.
Did you make a lot of money?
We made enough money to be happy in Chapel Hill as young grads, which meant we had, you know, we could feed ourselves and play basketball in the evenings. But no, it was at the end of the day, I think it was. It was an incredible experience, and ultimately, yeah, we made enough money to survive.
Well, how did I don't want to call that anything other than a real job if you're making money and paying the bills. But yep. How did that lead to another real job?
Sure. Well, I you know, when I joined John to do this, I really was excited about the creative process, editing and filming and writing, and I still love all that stuff. But what I found – I never took a business class as an undergrad, zero, poli-sci major. But working at UAV, I really did over those years kind of fall in love with the dynamics of business. Coming up with the business plan, deciding who was our target customer going to be, writing proposals to pitch our services, making sales calls, even – balancing the books with accounting software. And so over those couple of years, I guess my vision for where I wanted to take a career shifted a little bit. I probably imagined that I would stay in the film production business, but I learned that I liked the business side of it. So I went to business school. After about 4 years, went off to graduate school.
From this business,
yes.
With John, you closed the business and went to school.
I exited. John continued to do some amazing work for a few more years. But I exited and got married in 1989. And Jane and I, moved away and went to business school.
So you went to Harvard Business School.
I did.
And how did you get in? Did the Moorhead just open the door for you, or were your grades?
I had a good record. It was not, you know.
And you brought the actual business experience and a drive to know what you wanted to learn.
That's right. I do think – I think the fact that I had participated in a pretty scrappy startup business and it was maybe put me in one of those boxes. I mean, all my classmates were bankers and consultants and worked for P&G. And I think I was one of those token entrepreneurs.
Well, just taken a look at the admissions challenge at the Harvard Business School, where you're overrun with applications and everybody wants to go. What is the what's the key to getting in if you're coming from an unusual kind of background and experience? You could bring something to the table.
Exactly. I think the unusual background was the positive.
Well, what was the experience at Harvard Business School like?
It was hard. It was a lot of work. I was married. Jane and I lived off campus. We were very happy there.
Did you live in Cambridge in the nearby? Or
we lived in Somerville,
okay,
which was a you know, less expensive suburb to the north of Cambridge. And Jane, who'd grown up in North Carolina, had never lived up north, so it took some getting used to for her in the winters in Boston. But we had a good life there. Worked very, very hard. She worked, and I went to school, and we were there for 2 years. And I had a summer internship after my first year with the Disney Channel out in Burbank, California.
With the channel.
With the Disney Channel.
Taking your experience.
Yes.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's take a break and then come back, and then we'll go to California and Disney.
Fantastic.
If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Tim Sullivan. Tim is the former president and CEO of Ancestry.com. We're talking a little bit about his chapel experience and how that led to the prominent position in the business world. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Tim Sullivan. Tim is the former CEO of Ancestry.com and has a quite remarkable business and educational career, a large part of which took place in Chapel Hill. We've talked about that. And if you missed it, you can find it online at chapelborough.com. Tim, we got you all the way through Harvard Business School and with the summer working for Disney.
The Disney Channel.
The Disney Channel.
The Disney Channel. The cable channel. My internship after my first year was in L.A., and we packed our car and drove out to Los Angeles for the summer and had a great experience there.
What did you do as an intern?
Well, at that I one of the more interesting projects I remember doing was putting together a financial model for the idea of a new cable channel that they were kicking around, I think based on game shows.
Uh-huh.
They ended up not doing it. I think somebody else ended up launching a channel like that. But I worked with a team there at the Disney Channel, and I was kind of the numbers guy coming from business school. And I spent a lot of
hours. You just did it like a Harvard Business School case method.
That's exactly right. Exactly right.
Well, I don't want to get too far off track because there's too much more I want to talk to and want you to talk to me about. But, I mean, what a coincidence that now Disney is trying to figure out how to move its assets and its experience into new technology. Then it was with the cable channel. And today, how are we going to use this?
Direct-to-consumer streaming is the game now, for sure.
Well, are they calling you and getting your advice about this?
No. Well, I went back. I went back to after graduating, I got a job there.
Uh-huh.
I got a job in the home video group. So this was pre-DVD. This was manufacturing VHS cassettes and a little bit of Betamax.
Taking the content primarily from the films.
Taking the animated classics from the Disney library, the new animated classics like Lion King and Toy Story, and then the live-action films that Touchstone Pictures and Hollywood Pictures was producing and distributing those. And I worked for 8 years there. The entire time was in the home video group. And actually, the entire time was in the international home video group.
At this point, the technology was the videotapes? Is that right?
Cassettes.
No, DVDs at that point?
No. In 94... or 95, I can't recall. 94, we moved to Hong Kong, where I helped set up the Asia-Pacific regional office for this home video group. And we had a few years of incredible growth in the business out there as home video was exploding and Disney was producing just incredible films.
So Hong Kong would be a good market, and then some of Singapore and the other rich. But could you go into mainland China and sell these?
We ultimately did. It took a few years, and I traveled through a lot of parts of mainland China trying to figure out how to create a business when piracy was just out of control.
Well, I mean, this is not about me, but I just remember going in China, and I could get any video I wanted to, but it wasn't put going into the pocket of the originator.
Exactly, exactly.
So how did you deal with it?
Well, we worked with the government to try to get them to care a little bit more about protecting, you know, intellectual property. But I think there was also. We ultimately found a partner who really wanted to operate the business, and we licensed our content to that partner.
So what made you exit China and Disney?
Well, we were there through 99. We'd been in Hong Kong for 4 years. Both of our kids were born there. We loved living in Hong Kong. I was traveling a lot through the region. Korea and Taiwan and Australia, sometimes Japan. But in 99, I think Jane and I were both really ready to get back home. And there was this thing happening around that time called the internet. And it was clear to me. I loved Disney and I loved the home video business. But I just realized, man, this internet technology thing was just changing. It was already changing everything. And so move back to the U.S. And,
well, now you're sitting in Hong Kong, traveling around doing your business, then you're starting to communicate by email.
Yes.
You're sending content by email. And so you're this is bugging you? You're saying, I need to figure out a way, or did other things just happen?
No, I think it was clear back then that this was I hate to even call the internet an industry. I mean, this was a world-changing phenomenon / technology / industry all rolled into one. And I just wanted in on that. I wanted to be part of that.
I mean, let me probe about this.
Yeah.
So lots of people said this is really going to have a big impact, the ability to communicate and exchange data and information. And you said the same thing, but then you said, I want to ride this wave. Is that
exactly? I knew I'd been at Disney for 8 years. You know, I wasn't sure if I really wanted to stay there for 40. And when we moved back to the U.S., I just started looking around and was determined that I wanted to find my next job.
You're still working for Disney, or did you break off and come back without a job?
It's funny. I moved back to the United States, and believe it or not, for 6 months. I continued to manage the Asia Pacific region, the home video business for the Asia Pacific region from LA. I literally commuted to Asia. I'd get on a plane, you know, on a Saturday night at midnight and show up in one of the Asia Pacific offices at Monday morning, spend about 2 weeks on the ground, come home, be home for 2 weeks, and then back to Asia for 2 weeks. That got a little old.
Well, so you're wearing yourself out going back and forth and working, and how are you finding time to kind of explore what options might be available in this new internet wave that is going to change the world?
Well, it was every day in the newspaper. I also had a very dear friend who's still a dear friend who had been one of the founders of City Search. And so when I was back in Los Angeles, I would oftentimes grab a beer with him and learn about what he was doing. And so I kind of got a little familiarity with the terrain. In fact, that was my first job. He introduced me as he was leaving the company. His name is Thomas Layden, good friend. Has a daughter here at Carolina now.
Well, he gave you his company. He gave you the job.
He introduced me to the people who ultimately offered me a job there and went to work for City Search. It was called a company called.
What did City Church do?
Well, it was pre-Yelp. It was a series of local websites about local content. It was merged with Ticketmaster Online. So long, complicated story. But the idea was that Ticketmaster Online could, you know, be quite synergistic to these local websites. And I worked in Pasadena for Ticketmaster Online / City Search.
What are you doing?
Well, I was the vice president of e-commerce, and the idea I was charged with figuring out a way to get Ticketmaster into the business of selling music and concert paraphernalia and T-shirts. Unfortunately, it was not a very good idea.
Sounds like a pretty good idea to me.
You have the customer base there. Yeah. But at that time, and I don't know if it's still the case, Ticketmaster was not a very well-loved brand. So the idea that people wanted to actually purchase anything from Ticketmaster other than the tickets that they had to turned out not to be a gangbusters idea.
Well, I want to talk to you, or have you talked to us, about how that experience, the job and the aspirations led ultimately to Ancestry.com. If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Tim Sullivan, the former CEO of Ancestry.com. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Talk, and this is D.G. Martin. My guest is Tim Sullivan. Tim is a Morehead Scholar at Chapel Hill, and then went on to have a wonderful and fabulous business career that he's talking about, ultimately becoming the CEO of Ancestry.com. And we're talking about how you got there, and it's incredible. You're leaving Disney to work for a very challenging, aspirational thing that should work but didn't work.
Exactly.
This is Ticketmaster.
Ticketmaster on the idea that we were going to become a retailer of music and concert stuff other than tickets.
Well, I mean, what's not a good idea? Excuse me. Nobody wants to listen to me talk, but I love the idea that you've got a group of potential customers locked in for you, and you figure out, or at least brainstorm about how to serve that in a way that will make money for you.
Yeah.
And this is what you were doing at that time. Maybe not totally successfully.
No. What was we successfully built the Ticketmaster store. So we had a small team really off to the side. And Ticketmaster was a giant company, but we were just this little rebel team trying to figure out how to build a store to leverage that customer base. We did. We had CDs and concert T-shirts and all sorts of stuff, and we built it, but it just wasn't a hugely successful revenue driver.
It was an example of what could be done now with the internet in place, where you can have a store, or you can deliver stuff or information or something to a group of customers that somebody else has sort of assembled for you.
Exactly, and there really was very little, you know, prepackaged e-commerce infrastructure back then. So a lot of the stuff we had to build on our own and hack it together. But now it's much easier.
I mean, your business could have become Amazon.com.
Well,
I mean, you got a store and you're selling stuff and you do it successfully.
We had vision. We had high hopes. Let's just say that.
Well, why didn't it work out?
Well, I think it really was. Well, two reasons. One, companies like Amazon and CD Now and other companies at that time were selling merchandise really at below cost, because it was all about acquiring customers who now, you know, in hindsight are worth thousands or tens of thousands of dollars. But they knew that. So they would sell CDs at below cost to try to acquire customers. So it was very hard for us to sell a Britney Spears T-shirt or the latest NSYNC CD and make any money doing that when you were going up these big guys that had the long game in mind, where they were just going to buy customers by offering incredible deep discounts. And again, Ticketmaster was not a very well-loved brand. So people really on a Saturday morning, what they wanted was to get in, get their tickets, and get out. Wow. They didn't want to mess around and purchase anything else.
What got you out of that challenge?
Well, I was working in Pasadena for this group for about a year and a half. You know, that thing kind of wound down, and I didn't have a real heady mission. Didn't have a big job. Actually, there were a few months there where I was twiddling my thumbs. But the company had purchased this interesting little company called Match.com. It was based in Dallas, Texas. It was tiny. Not tiny. It was, you know, very small, but probably 1/100th of the size of it is
now. Just to be clear, Ticketmaster bought?
Well, it was, again, Ticketmaster Online City Search. So the idea was that
group of companies.
Online dating would be a nice little tuck-in business inside City Search.
I'm looking for a place to eat, and I'm looking for somebody to go with me there.
You got it. Exactly. Restaurant reservations.
I would have never thought of that.
Yeah. And online dating and classifieds.
So did that become a good fit? Did it?
Yeah. So I was given the chance to go be COO of Match.com.
I guess everybody knows what Match.com is, but it's famous now. I mean, it's big time.
It's changed the world. Right. Online dating was tiny back then. Nobody really knew or really thought it was going to be very big or interesting. And I agreed to commute from Dallas for 6 months to help with this business and immediately fell in love with the business. And so ultimately about 6 months later, they gave me the job of being CEO.
Why
moved to Dallas.
Why did you fall in love with this business putting lonely people together?
Well, one, it was clear it had tremendous potential to be huge. And it was a challenge because it was direct to consumer, which I loved that, you know, being able to advertise and then in real time see the cash register ring, you know, and people sign up. It was a subscription business. And it was doing good things. I mean, it was helping people meet people to go out on dates and fall in love and start a family. So it was full of fun. It was exciting. It was growing.
Well, did that transform you in the way you were doing, working at a online store that wasn't really successful, and all of a sudden you're into something where you can see happy? Well, I mean, there are challenges, of course, too, but you can see a lot of happy results.
Yes, it did. And what it also transformed me, it was very successful. I mean, it was about a $40 million business when I joined it, spent about 3-4 years there. And I think, you know, by that time it had grown to about a $200 million business. Now that's, you know, more than 10x that. It's grown massively.
So you're making the people who've given you these opportunities, you're making them big bucks.
Yeah, we were owned ultimately by the company controlled by Barry Diller, right? So for a while, I worked for the management team at Ticketmaster Online City Search in L.A. And then the last year or two, I spent working directly for Mr. Diller.
Now, what was that like?
It was challenging. He brilliant, brilliant businessman, incredibly creative, very demanding, very challenging. Truthfully, over time, at the end, we didn't get along perfectly well. I was probably a little bit too cocky and headstrong.
This is off the subject, but I'm always interested in when you encounter a successful person, whether that person is an enabler or a dictator sort of leader. And how did you just, if you were clashing with Diller, then there were some times where he knew that he had better ideas than you did. How did that work?
Well, that's right. I think if I thought I had a great idea, I was probably a little too stubborn for the position I was in, given his experience and total control over the business. And ultimately, you know, he decided that it was time to make a change and that Tim Sullivan had done a great job there for a couple of years, but it was time for Tim to move on. And that was hard. It was the first time I'd gotten canned. And
well, was it a fair? Did they compensate you for what you done?
Oh, treated me incredibly well, mm-hmm. incredibly well.
So you're out of a job with resources and staying power. And now, what do you want to do?
Yeah, so I had a little bit of a contract for about a year where they continued to pay me. So I did a lot of gardening and hanging out in Dallas. Drove Jane crazy, working from home, and really just not aggressively for a while, but starting to look for my next job and talking to companies and trying to figure out what to do. What I knew I loved, I wanted to stay in the internet, loved technology, loved – it had to be something that touched consumers. I loved internet subscription models, which Match was, and ultimately was recruited to go lead – what was then called MyFamily.com, well, but it was Ancestry.
This is going to be Ancestry. Well, let's take a break and then come back and talk about your move into Ancestry. We won't have much time to talk about what you did, but maybe you'll come back sometime soon and we can But for those of you who joined us late, I'm visiting with Tim Sullivan. We've been talking about his business career, and folks know him mostly as the former CEO of Ancestry.com, and that's what we'll be talking about after the short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Tim Sullivan. Tim is a graduate of Carolina, a Morehead Scholar. Came back recently to give the Eve Carson a memorial lecture. And again, Tim, you did a great job.
Thank you.
And one of the reasons that everybody loved hearing you talk was that you told us a little bit about your work at Ancestry.com. We've got you all the way to the door. So what opened the door to Ancestry, and why did they want you, and why did you think it would at that point in time, why did you think that might be a right place for you?
Right. Look, I think I was a good candidate for the role of CEO in that I had run Match.com for a couple of years. I knew the internet subscription dynamic, had direct-to-consumer stuff. I saw in it just tremendous potential, similar to Match, but quite different. Similar in that there was a sense that genealogy was a nice niche business, but there was this chance to really turn it into something massive and mass market, which is kind of what had happened with
what
Match.
Was not there that you thought
the product was a little clunky. I mean, the folks that had preceded me had done an incredible job digitizing all these records and archival documents.
So this was on the document side,
exactly,
of exploring your ancestry. And that,
exactly,
was, as you and I talked earlier, this was in part a byproduct, a complementary to being in Utah near the Mormon Church.
Yeah, it was founded by a couple of young guys years ago who were part of the LDS Church. Passionate about genealogy, we partnered with the church, but we partnered with the National Archives and state archives all over the world.
So the idea at that point was not strictly, but primarily, we're going to track down records that will help you find your family background.
Exactly, we would digitize records. We'd go into an archive and at our cost, digitize those records. We would then send the images to China, where they'd be transcribed, so that they could all be, you know, served through a search engine. And so a genealogist or somebody interested in doing their family history could sit at home and do a search of the entire, you know, 1930 census rather than going to the library and scrolling through microfilm and microfiche. So
now, was this in place when you got there?
That idea was in place. Yes. Yes. But I think the front end of that experience, the product experience, was a little bit clunky. And we just invested a lot in new technology and trying to make that experience easier and easier for more and more people. And that's what propelled growth for many, many years.
And so that was one of your objectives, smooth out the search experience for the
Exactly.
And then, but there must have been something else in terms of getting more customers. And how were you going to get more customers?
Well, we began advertising very aggressively on television. We built an online family tree system that became a little more social so that you could invite other members of your family to help build that tree. And then ultimately, we saw this growing consumer DNA opportunity.
So your current competitors were already in the business, or did you start this business?
Well, 23andMe was the first of the big direct-to-consumer DNA companies, pretty much focused on giving people insights about their health, but also doing a little bit of this family history. And I think we saw that this was just a natural thing for us to be doing.
So this is new. You brought this this is under your regime.
Yes.
That you're bringing the DNA complement.
Yeah.
And how did that – was that an easy thing to do?
Well, I think there was – I remember the day we just were sitting around our conference table at Ancestry and realized this is a category that we really – we need to be in this and we need to invest aggressively in the DNA business because this is something that has the potential to be huge.
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No.
Do you start the business or do you just go out and acquire somebody?
That's a great question. We looked around at potential companies to acquire and realized there really wasn't a good company to acquire. Mm. The fellow who I had hired as a consultant to help me figure out who the potential companies to acquire were, I ended up tapping him and hiring him to start the business internally. Which is what we did. We hired a team, and hired scientists, and cut the deals with labs, built the website, and then we built it inside and launched it ourselves.
Did you have the idea that the blending of these two aspects, the paper, the history paper plus the genetic, that would enable you to beat your competitor who are in just doing the DNA stuff?
Well, I think in some ways, yes. We had the ability because when we sold a DNA kit to somebody, there was an X percent chance that we'd be able to convince that person to become a long-term Ancestry subscriber. For us, DNA was almost profitable from day one. I don't think
So it was a loss leader. It was a loss leader that became profitable or was profitable.
Exactly. So we invested a ton of money in technology and in advertising, and we leveraged this phenomenal Ancestry brand, which was pretty well known at that point because the company had grown quite a bit. And you're right; it was a huge accelerator of growth for that core business because now you had millions and millions of people trying family history. They didn't have to sign up to become a subscriber. They could take a test, they could get some results, and some of them would get really excited about this and become subscribers. So that drove really accelerated growth.
They'd see that they had cousins and then they'd say, "I want to know how we're connected." And you could do that on the record side.
Exactly.
Well, what was missing? I mean, looking back, I mean, you got two kind of separate businesses that became great partners. Wasn't there something else that with this subscriber base that you could have put in the mix that would have been even more profitable?
Well, we tried so many different things. We tried maybe we could come up with ways to sell people books of their family history without them doing any work. That didn't work. We tried DNA. That did work. We said, wait a minute, why don't we set up a business of really high-quality professional genealogists where some people with big bucks wanted to come pay us thousands of dollars.
The Henry Louis Gates experience.
To replicate that worked.
That worked.
We saw in newspapers, we were talking about that earlier, mm-hmm. we saw in newspapers an idea that we could create a separate site just dedicated to newspapers. So we built a website called newspapers.com, and that worked. So we were constantly experimenting with new ideas that would leverage the brand that were in our category. Some worked and some didn't.
Well, you're no longer CEO. You're chairman, I think, of the board.
Yeah, the board.
So you've got a great interest and a financial interest in the success of the company. What's open for it to do? And what are the risks that it faces in terms of other smart people with good ideas coming in to compete?
Well, I think no matter how much a leader you are, and Ancestry is a very significant leader, you got to go to bed every night fearing that somebody's going to wake up the next morning with a better idea and take you on. And Ancestry, and that's so I think we were constantly motivated by protecting our position as the number one. Ancestry continues to be a phenomenal business. The DNA business is a little bit down. That's been reported in the press.
Oh, really? I missed that.
Consumers over the past couple of years, and understandably so, have become concerned generally about data privacy on the web, and there's some stories about worries about how DNA data.
Yeah, in your great talk at the Eve Carson lecture, you talked about some of these things, which are very important. Yes. And I'd just like to say, will you come back and let's talk about some of the downsides as well as the upside of the DNA revolution?
I would love to talk about the upsides and the downsides.
And this is the upsides and downsides of your experience, and mostly the upsides has been a fascinating thing for us to explore today. Tim Sullivan, thanks so much.
It's been incredibly fun. Thank you.
Well, our guest has been Tim Sullivan. He's the former CEO of Ancestry.com, a great and loyal alumnus of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Hope we'll get him back, and I hope you'll tune in at the same time and listen to us. I'll see you then.